This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
It seems like it can't be right that I'm the one that Chris just put this recorder in front of. This is very surreal. I have already given this talk 10,000 times in my mind over the last 48 hours, but I guess I haven't given it to you guys yet, so here we go. Before I start, I just want to acknowledge that my friend Cynthia is here and came from Richmond, Virginia for this, and Barry had suggested that I invite some friends and family, and you know, I had to go through who could possibly tolerate this, and there weren't that many people. Cynthia is one. Been friends for many, many years, and she has a practice as well and a group that she sits with. And you know, when I asked people, I didn't know how meaningful it would be if somebody showed up. It's very meaningful. So I hope that my talk is going to be about the precept of not sparing the Dharma assets. That's the talk that I wrote in my mind over the last couple months and practiced it and polished it. And then when I actually wrote it out yesterday and read it, I realized I couldn't give that talk because it was polished enough so that it would make me look deep and funny, which I am, both. But I had surgically removed all vulnerability from the talk. And I think that that is what the precept of not sparing the Dharma assets and the whole practice is about, is vulnerability. So I had to scrap that one, and I'm just going to do my best with no script except for the one that is going on the teleprompter in my mind. So what I want to try to talk about is how I got to this practice and tie it into the precept. Before I came to this group, maybe from the age of about 8 until 40, I was doing perfect person practice. That was my practice, perfect person practice. So it looked different at different times, but it was basically, I can be with people when I can be sure that I will be invulnerable. And otherwise, I have to not be with people. So there was a lot of hiding out that was happening. And I think I can talk about it. There's a through line that I can talk about with relationships with boys, later to be men, where, well, by the time I was 8, I knew that no boy would ever like me. It wasn't like I thought that thought, that was knowledge. I knew it. And so all I had to do was avoid any situation where anyone could ever think that I liked them or where I could be humiliated in some other way. So that meant, oh, I forgot to mention that I was a chubby kid, and that being a chubby girl in my culture, which is probably many of your cultures too, wasn't okay. That wasn't an okay thing. So it was very logical that I knew that no boys were going to like me because I was a chubby girl, and you couldn't be a chubby girl. So as a chubby girl, I was going to avoid all humiliating things. Sports, humiliating for many people. Avoid sports. Avoid being alone with any boys. Avoid the phone. Spend a lot of time in my room listening to Prince. So I did that. And it didn't seem bad, because it seemed like it's what I had to do. What else was I going to do? I had to do that. And at some point, I was going to start being a person who ate regularly spaced, small, plant-based meals. And I was going to do vigorous exercise and be fit and not have any extra fat on my body. And that would be when boys might like me. And so until then, I just had to hide and sort of fantasize and talk to Prince. What I think is very interesting, and the fact that my issue was that I had extra weight on my body, I don't think is particularly important, because many people identify something that's wrong with them and have to hide. And it's very slow and insidious what happens from hiding, where I could sort of exist in this bubble by myself that seemed protective, but that more and more had this toxic atmosphere of shame and self-hatred and fear. And this is very, very gradual. You know, I didn't notice it. I didn't know that that was the atmosphere that I was in. I thought I was in an atmosphere that was real. The atmosphere of, you're not okay. You'll be okay later, you're not okay now. And so you just survive until you get okay. So I had to do more and more things to be able to hide more and more. Like I started to leave the country and go places where I couldn't be found. So I went to Mexico, I went to El Salvador, deep in the jungle where there was no access. I went to Brazil, deep in the jungle, no access. For years I did this. And I would, you know, take on another way of hiding in plain sight would be to take on harder and harder jobs that no human could do, but I was doing them. And it sort of was, that could act as an armor and a protectant for me. To just not be vulnerable. So at a certain point, there started to be some crises that were coming from me not being connected with people. And one that I can think of, one of the times when I was living in Mexico, I had a terrible bout of self-hatred. And it was, you know, out loud and, you know, me just saying, I can't live with myself. I can't be this way. And I woke up, I was saying these words and crying and in pain, physical pain. And I woke up in the morning and I had Bell's palsy. So I had this side of my face totally slack. And I couldn't reach out to anybody and then even and say, I need help, come with me to the doctor, you know, I couldn't do it. And I didn't do it, and we don't know whether my face would have gotten totally better or not if I had done it, but I couldn't. So things would start to happen, or I would have just bouts of needing to not be alive. I already was sort of not alive, but just, you know, I can't do this. I can't do this life. So I started going to meditation retreats, you know, I guess something inside of me was trying to reconnect me, and so I started going to meditation retreats, which were so great, mostly because in Vipassana, unlike Zen, if you go to a Vipassana retreat, there's teachers there, and they're basically just telling you from the beginning to the end, you're okay. You're okay. Whatever is happening, you're all right. There's nothing wrong with you. And that was really good. It turned out that I was able, as many people are, to turn that into perfect person practice also, because it was amazing, because I could go on retreat. Long retreats. Those people do long retreats. I didn't have to talk to anybody, but there were a lot of people around, and there were nice people talking to me, and I couldn't fail. But I would come back into my regular life, and it was the same as it ever was. You know, I needed to be a perfect person. Going on retreat was helping me to become a perfect person, I thought. But it was, I wasn't perfect. I wasn't perfect. So a couple years ago, I went on one of these retreats. This was a shorter one. And the short ones are really terrible because I get all this self-hatred cooks up and I don't have the time to let it burn off like I do in a longer retreat. So I came back from the retreat and I saw Barry, and I said to him, I realized on the retreat that I just need to be more mindful. And I'm sure that you looked at me skeptically, and I don't know if it was you or me who said, that can't be the answer. The answer can't be that I try harder to be a perfect person. Okay, so that was the end of perfect person practice. And then I started doing this practice, Zen practice, which is really awful because there's no hope that there's no hope that I'm going to be a perfect person. There's no hope that I am going to be invulnerable. Quite the contrary. Exactly the counter to that. So when I was the way that I was, that I can still be sometimes, I would often have the feeling I know there's a net, there's a web, we're all in the web, and I think that the image is the net of Indra, where we're all gemstones, many faceted gemstones, and we are sort of at the junctures of knots in the net. And we wiggle around and reflect each other's light. And when I would, you know, go through these bouts that were coming more and more frequently, where I just wanted to not be alive, I would have the feeling that I had fallen out of the net. And really perfect person practice always was trying to wriggle out of the net. That's what that practice is. But I can't be out of the net. I can't be out of the net. I have to be in the net. And the net is, there's a lot of pain and suffering in the net. So one of the things that is part of being the net in the net for me is dating. Now I date. The jury is still out on whether boys are going to like me or not, but I date. And if there is any example of how excruciating it is to be in the net, it's dating. Where I have to show up, I have no armor going into these dates. I have no armor. I might be totally self-conscious, and I usually am, but I don't have any armor. You can't have any armor. And things happen. Sometimes I like the man, they don't like me. Sometimes they decide they don't like me before we meet. Sometimes they decide they don't like me after we meet. Sometimes I can't stand them. Which is, it's better, but it's still not good. It's still not good. You know, the feeling of dismissing another human being as not good enough. For me, it's still not a good feeling. So there's that. But there's also just the unpredictability of being in the net, where I'm connected to all these people. More and more I connect to people, more and more I don't say no. And that means that I am subject to them, all of them. I'm subject to their whims. I'm subject to their abilities to show up or not. It is... I have never ever felt as much as I feel now. A lot of fear, a lot of still a bunch of shame and self-blame and all of those things. So it sounds really bad. I know it sounds really bad. But a couple of things. One thing is that not sparing the Dharma assets, it is impossible to share my assets when I'm hidden. And I suspect that my greatest asset, it might be everybody's greatest asset, but I think it is mine, is my vulnerability. I think that might be the greatest thing that I can offer, and I can only offer it if I'm in the net. And I can't be in the net painted over with non-reflective black tar. I have to be in the net, shining my light and absorbing everyone else's light. And back to Cynthia, my friend. Being in the net makes it so that I can more and more have the sensation of being like a rock star when they get air surfed around the crowd. You know, when the rock star falls into the hands of the crowd and they push him or her, they sort of carry them through the crowd. And if I'm not in the net, I don't get to have that. But being in the net, I do get to have it. So both things can happen. I can share what I have to give, which is, I think, not knowable. What I have to give is not knowable. It appears in each moment. But it's an asset. If I can show up and be vulnerable, I can know and rest that what I'm offering is an asset. I think I will stop there. Thank you for listening.